Today is Wednesday, September 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, officials continue looking into who attacked a major Saudi oil production facility and what to do about it.
It could be met with an attack many, many times larger very easily by our country, but we're going to find out who definitively did it first.
Israel's deadlocked election leaves Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in limbo. Also ahead, remembering a pioneer American journalist who lost her battle with breast cancer. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said that it is looking like Iran was behind this weekend's attacks carried out on oil facilities in Saudi Arabia, but said the U.S. is not looking at retaliatory options until there is definitive proof that Tehran was responsible. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara has the latest.
The series of drone attacks in Saudi Arabia, striking the heart of its oil production over the weekend, continues to raise tensions. On Monday, U.S. President Donald Trump came close to placing outright blame on Tehran. He spoke at the White House after meeting with Crown Prince Salman of Bahrain.
As soon as we find out definitively, we'll let you know, but it does look that way.
Trump insisted he does not want war with Iran, but said the U.S. is ready militarily.
That was a very large attack, and it could be met with an attack many, many times larger very easily by our country, but we're going to find out who definitively did it first.
The Iran-aligned Houthi group that controls Yemen's capital claimed responsibility. The U.S. has not offered any evidence proving Iran was behind the attack. Tehran denies any involvement, calling the accusations maximum lies.
Yemeni people are exercising their legitimate right of defense. The attacks are reciprocal, and the main solution is to halt these attacks. The solution for the Yemeni crisis is also political.
The special envoy of the Secretary General for Yemen told the UN Security Council that the attack has far-reaching consequences.
This extremely serious incident makes the chances of a regional conflict that much higher and of a rapprochement that much lower.
Despite the attacks, Trump said there is still a path to diplomacy. Fears of widening hostilities in the region have sent oil prices soaring. Saudi Arabia said it will invite UN and international experts to investigate. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this is Amin Saikal, director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us, sir. What do you expect happens next?
Washington has claimed that Iran is responsible, but of course they will have to provide a lot more hard evidence before they can prove that, yes, Iran is the culprit. I mean, the Iranian allies, the Houthis in Yemen, have claimed responsibility for it. But what Secretary Pompeo and others in Washington have said is that the degree of sophistication which is used is not something which Houthis can manage. Therefore, I think Iran is very much behind this whole incident. On the other hand, of course, President Trump, as usual, has been somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, he said that, you know, we are ready really to respond to this Iranian attack. On the other hand, he said that he really does not want war. My reading of the situation at this stage is that President Trump really doesn't want a war with Iran. But that's why Secretary for State Pompeo has flown to Saudi Arabia to see what precisely the Saudis want to say and whether if the Saudis want to respond, would they really take the lead? And obviously, they will be supported by the United States. But I think at this stage, it looks like that President Trump does not want to really jump the guns and to send a military response to the Iranians.
But we're hearing that behind closed doors, there is talk of a potential strike on Iran. What would something like that... How dangerous would something like that be, given the volatility of the Middle East in general?
Well, I think it would be very dangerous because the Iranians have already demonstrated a capability to cause a lot of havoc in the region. I mean, you know, they have downed an American drone, which they did a few months ago, and they have also been accused of being involved in blowing up a few oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman, as well as in the Persian Gulf. I think it would be erroneous to think that the Iranians are not going to retaliate Of course, the Americans will have the firepower with the help of the Saudis and even possibly Israelis, you know, to cause a lot of damage to Iran. And if they go for an attack, they will be certainly targeting Iranian nuclear sites, Iranian military installations, and some of the strategic points and so on. But at the same time, Iran, U.S. targets, and Saudi targets, which may suffer, but also there would be many other targets in the region that the Iranians could hit.
It would seem, though, that Iran and the Houthis would both have motives that you could pinpoint why they would want to do something like this. Nonetheless, sort of puts the entire world in a position of how to deal with something like this because of all the dangers you mentioned.
Absolutely. And I think the Europeans have called for restraint, and the UN Secretary General has called for restraint. And of course, also some of Iran's strong international supporters like Russia and China. I mean, they would not really want to see a Middle East war because it is going to be damaging to all sides, and particularly for the people of the region. I think these are the sort of issues that they have to really think about before shooting conflict is ignited. I mean, at the moment, we are at the stage of blames and counter-blames and counter-claims. I mean, the Iranians have denied, and they've said, look, we've had nothing to do with it. But obviously, the Houthi allies have really claimed responsibility for that. But the United States saying that, no, I think it's Iran behind it. So they will have to really provide a lot of evidence. And whether the United States at this stage wants to take the lead in striking Iran, or probably would like to really to see the Saudis really doing something and then the Americans supporting it.
Because ultimately, this was an attack on Saudi soil.
And also, there is a deficit of goodwill in the Congress towards Saudi Arabia at the moment. I don't think that there are many people in the Congress that would like to support the idea of the United States going into war with Iran on behalf of Saudi Arabia. We know that even some of the Republican members of the Congress have already come out and they've said that, look, it would be wrong for the United States to engage in a military confrontation with Iran.
If ultimately the U.S. were to offer concrete proof that Iran's hand was in this, and they don't, and there is no military response, is that basically giving Iran and any other actors that would like to pull off these types of attacks, does that give them sort of the impression that they can get away with it?
I think the Iranians will also have to be very careful. I don't think that the Iranian leadership wants a war either. If they feel that they can get away with something like this, and if that's really proven, then they will have to really think twice that if they would like to really continue this sort of action, so simply because of that eventually the United States and its allies will respond in the region, and I don't think that the Iranians would find that to their advantage. I think what the Iranians are really doing is sending a number of signals to the Americans that what you're really doing in terms of imposing these draconian sanctions on Iran, causing a lot of hardship for the Iranian people and also isolating Iran in the region. But now Iran has really the capability to sort of head back. But they will have to be very, very careful that if they really go beyond certain deadlines, then that may well eventually really provoke the United States to engage in military actions. And that's not going to be to the advantage of Iran either.
All right. That is Amin Saikal, professor of political science and director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. UN mission in Afghanistan is renewed after a brief stalemate. An explosion causes a fire at a Russian lab housing the smallpox virus. UN Rapporteur visits Zimbabwe to assess the human rights situation there. And an ex-campaign chief defends President Trump at a chaotic impeachment hearing. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fell short of securing a parliamentary majority with his religious and nationalist allies in national elections Tuesday, initially setting the stage for a period of coalition negotiations that could threaten his political future and clear the way for him to be tried on corruption charges. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The exit polls were announced at 10 p.m. just as the polls closed in Israel. Based on all three exit polls, Netanyahu is not able to form a majority coalition of 61 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. Likud cabinet minister Tzachi Hanegbi said he believed Netanyahu's chances will improve as the final votes are counted. He said he still believes Netanyahu has the best chance of forming a government. Once final results are in, Netanyahu's president will consult with the leaders of each of the parties and recommend either Netanyahu or Gantz to try to put together a government. So far, it doesn't look like either the right wing or the center-left will be able to do that. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
In Zimbabwe, tensions between the government and a family of Robert Mugabe are creating uncertainty about what to do with the unpopular late leader's body. The ruling party recently revealed that it owns the family's home, a move widely seen as pressuring family members who've been resisting the government's wishes for Mugabe's burial. VOA's Anita Powell explores this complex tale of power, personalities, and politics that includes a former first lady facing a litany of legal challenges.
Weeping, she followed his casket, her footsteps heavy, her body draped in black lace. In public, Grace Mugabe has been the picture of the dignified, dutiful widow since her husband, former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, died earlier this month at the age of 95. But behind the scenes, it's a different matter, as salacious details leak out while the government and Mugabe family negotiate with increasing bitterness about the fate of the leader's body. It has become a battle going well beyond Grace Mugabe and her family to reach the highest levels of Zimbabwe's complicated struggle for power. Derek Matyshek, a Harare-based governance consultant, says the fulcrum was in 2017, as speculation grew that the ailing leader wanted to install his much younger wife in his place. Amid this tension, Mugabe, allegedly under pressure from Grace, fired his deputy, Emmerson Mnangagwa. 3 weeks later, Mnangagwa used the military to pressure Mugabe to resign. Throughout, Matyshek says, it was critical for Mnangagwa to paint the power transition as a peaceful, voluntary one. Mugabe himself disputed that, calling it an outright coup, words that have hurt Mnangagwa's legitimacy. But now that Mugabe is dead, Matyshek says, the gloves are off between him and Grace Mugabe.
She's in a very weakened position from how she was before Mugabe's death. It was very expedient for Mnangagwa to continue to extol Mugabe as a liberation icon. So Mnangagwa has been at pains to say that all is well between him and Mugabe and to try and present that face to the world and to the regional leaders. The problem has always been, of course, Grace Mugabe, because many people believed that it was because of Grace Mugabe that Mnangagwa was fired from office by Robert Mugabe, but out of deference to Mugabe and because of that expediency, Grace was largely left alone.
Although most of these conversations have occurred behind closed doors, tantalizing details have leaked out as the funeral plans have changed multiple times and the family appears to be resisting the government's wishes to bury Mugabe in the National Heroes Acre Cemetery. The state-run Herald newspaper this week reported that the ruling party owns Mugabe's Harare mansion, a revelation widely seen as an attempt by the ruling party to exert leverage on the family. The same day, the family called off plans to send the body to Mugabe's rural village, with no explanation. The family most recently said the burial would take place in 30 days, a move that could be seen as buying time. Grace Mugabe has few places to go. She faces arrest in South Africa for allegedly assaulting a South African model with an electrical extension cord in 2017. And she's under sanctions and travel bans from the European Union and the United States. Family member Leo Mugabe says her future is straightforward. He spoke to VOA on the sidelines of Mugabe's public viewing in Harare.
Well, she will settle here. She's Zimbabwean. She has no reason to go anywhere. She will be at her house. And I'm sure she will start to do her normal work that she always been doing before, you know, the farm, you know, the business.
But she also faces legal problems at home. And Zimbabwe's notoriously politicized judiciary means those may resurface, says Matyshek.
And there are charges relating to ivory smuggling, which are are out there, and these things suddenly gain a new lease of life anytime the Mugabes venture into politics. She certainly needs to keep a low profile, and I think she might find things here a little bit uncomfortable.
VOA requested an interview with Mrs. Mugabe, but the family did not respond to the request. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
The Trump administration is revoking California's authority to set auto mileage standards, AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Conservative and free market groups have been invited to Environmental Protection Agency headquarters in Washington Wednesday afternoon, where the Trump administration will formally announce it is stripping California's authority to set auto mileage standards. The Justice Department recently opened an antitrust investigation into a deal between California and four automakers for more stringent pollution and related mileage requirements than those wanted by President Donald Trump. Word of the pending announcement came as Trump was traveling in California for fundraising events. California Attorney General Javier Becerra says the state will challenge the administration in federal court. Mike Gracia, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News. Excuse me, VOA News International Edition. We'll be right back.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, there are several new movies out in theaters, and among them are stories taking on some serious topics. Joining us to talk about two of the newest movies is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Award season is upon us. Goldfinch is among those that's getting a lot of buzz. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, the Toronto Film Festival just concluded, and the major award season kickoff is with that film festival, and the studios start to bring out some of their big guns early to get the buzz going. And one is The Goldfinch, and it's based on the best-selling novel about a little boy and his mother who are at an art gallery, and there's an explosion. There's a terrorist attack. And he survives, but one of the patrons hands him a painting and says, "Take this. Make sure it survives. Get out of here with it." And he gives him a ring of his partner. They own an antique dealership. So he ends up going to his shop, and he's technically an orphan now, and he is befriended by his partner. And throughout the years, this painting is hidden, and it's deemed to be lost. So it's about this little boy and this painting that follows him into his early adulthood, about the consequences, about his relationships with people. And there's a great scene. It kind of does flashback. It goes back and forth. Ansel Elgort plays the boy as an adult, but also you see a lot of the movie from his 12-year-old perspective. And Finn Wolfhard, who plays his best friend, he plays a Russian best friend from Russia, he delivers an amazing performance. This is the best-selling novel, so I have not read the book, but the movie comes in at 2.5 hours, and even though it's melodramatic and it's got some really interesting concepts to it in terms of the drama, I just felt that it was just too slow and not very interesting. You know, I know it's all centered around this painting, but I just didn't feel the connection to it. So I know the studio has big hopes on it. It's already technically flopped at the box office already. $60 million movies did like $3 million, so The Goldfinch, it may be a best-selling novel and has a fan base out there, but they didn't turn out for the movie.
That's interesting. Then we've got Hustlers, Jennifer Lopez starring in this. Some of the critics out there are basically saying that this is Jennifer Lopez's best performance of her career. What did you think?
Well, you know, the movie's called Hustlers, and it's based on a New York Magazine article about a series of strippers in the early 2000s when the economy tanked. They had to resort to different modes of making income. You know, we're not talking prostitution. We're talking about how they would find high-end clients like Wall Street fat cats, and they would take them out, and they would essentially drug them. They would roofie them and then take them back to their strip club where they would run up their credit cards, some of them $50,000 at a pop. And they started expanding out. They started getting other strippers involved and started taking a cut. So Jennifer Lopez plays the queen stripper, the queen bee, and she runs this organization where they're making tens of thousands of dollars. And Constance Wu plays a stripper. She's a mother. She's a single mother, and she's got morals. And she's like, look, we shouldn't be doing this, you know, but I need the money. I have to take care of my grandmother. The movie does have some interesting dilemmas for a tale of morality. But overall, I just hate that world of strippers. You know, I really do. And I understand that's the story, and it's a personal thing that, you know, I find the strip clubs and what they do, and I just find it very degrading to women. The movie, I think, is degrading to women. And of course, I've known strippers in the past, and some of them are very upstanding people. They're going to school, they're single mothers, but then a lot of the movie, it shows a lot of that behavior too. So I'm kind of conflicted. I didn't think Jennifer Lopez was good at all in this. I think it's an embarrassment for her career, especially Constance Wu, coming off an incredible beginning of her career, you know, with Crazy Rich Asians. I just didn't like it at all. I thought it was terrible. And also in this day and age of the Me Too movement, I just think women deserve a lot more respect, you know, especially cinematically, and with women making advances in filmmaking and just, you know, the glass ceiling is being broken. I understand that this movie is about strippers and about their story, but overall, I just don't think this movie should have been made.
All right. Jeffrey K. Howard, I can always count on you for honesty. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Ongoing fighting between Myanmar's military and the Kachin Independence Army has led to economic hardships resulting from land losses, displacement, and family separation. Many young Burmese women are seeking work in neighboring China, making them more vulnerable to human trafficking and forced marriages. Steve Sanford spoke with local activists and former victims in northern Myanmar about the impact of human trafficking, and he files this report.
Here in northern Myanmar's Kachin State, thousands of displaced family members with no jobs cross regularly into China, hoping to earn money. Largely because of China's one-child policy that ended in 2015, there are more men than women in China, driving a demand for women and girls from neighboring countries to wed and bear children. Often, the most vulnerable are tricked. This woman, who wants to remain anonymous, says she was promised a job by a friend, but was later drugged and held captive in China.
I've suffered and lived in terrible conditions. They were abusing me with sexual violence. I don't want to sleep with them, but they force me. And I begged them to let me go, but he didn't listen and he raped me until I became pregnant.
While some of the cases are clearly criminal, there are also transactions that start out as arranged marriages with promises of generous dowries. The Kachin Women's Association, a rights group, say some parents have good intentions but are unaware of the repercussions of arranged marriages that go sour.
I think many of the parents want their daughter to marry with a Chinese man because they think they will have a better life in China. They thought the Chinese government would take care of the Chinese citizens very well.
Sang Ra's job as a corn picker in China ended after the government tightened up border security. With the sudden loss of income, an arranged marriage of her 16-year-old daughter with a wealthy groom sounded good.
My daughter was still young and I didn't want her to get married at first, but the Chinese family said they'll take care of her. My relatives agreed that she'd have a better life, so I made the decision for my daughter to marry the Chinese man.
2 years later, after not being allowed to move freely or communicate, the daughter was permitted to return home for a visit, but stayed for good.
My friends keep asking me how it was to marry and live in China. Was it fun? Was I happy? I told them, it's not fun. I'm very sad and disappointed to have gotten married.
As new fighting between the government and Kachin rebels has put peace negotiations and the region's stability on hold, observers say that trafficking crimes are expected to increase. Steve Sanford for VOA News.
Speaking out about women and for women, Cokie Roberts, the daughter of politicians and a pioneering journalist who chronicled Washington politics from Jimmy Carter to Donald Trump for NPR and ABC News, died Tuesday of complications from breast cancer. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Cokie Roberts came from a political family. Together, her parents represented New Orleans in Congress for 46 years. Her 1966 wedding to Steve Roberts was attended by President Lyndon Johnson. She worked for various outlets until finding a place as a Capitol Hill correspondent for NPR in 1978 and contributed to PBS's McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. In 1988, she joined ABC.
Cokie Roberts, ABC News, Capitol Hill.
And co-anchored the Sunday show This Week with Sam Donaldson. Roberts is remembered for her warmth, her quick wit, and her astute political observations.
There's a huge change in the years that I've been plowing this turf.
The three-time Emmy winner is considered a pioneer for women in journalism.
Well, in her 2016 commencement address at UNC School of Journalism, Cokie Roberts told graduates that they share an important duty as they go into the world to tell their stories.
You must look at the institutions of government, politics, business, the academy, and journalism, and hold them accountable to the people they are supposed to serve.
Well, ABC broke the news, or broke into its network programming to announce the news of her death. Sympathies poured in. Former President Barack Obama said Roberts was a role model for women at a time the journalism profession was still dominated by men, and was a constant for over 40 years in a shifting media landscape and changing world. Former President George W. Bush and his wife Laura called Roberts a talented, tough, and fair reporter. Cokie Roberts was 75. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Without a name for so long, the beautiful smile to hide the pain. Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I would like to
This is VOA News.